Okay, my name is Laura Taddeyoshin. Thank you for coming out. This is a collaboration between visualization folks, GIS, and landscape architecture people. So this is the flow of my talk. I'll start by telling you what our motivation was for creating a tangible user interface for terrain modeling. So what is terrain modeling? Well, there are a lot of different kinds of terrain modeling problems. These are just a few. But they all share some common characteristics, or they often share common characteristics. One being that they usually involve some kind of landscape modification, whether it's anthropogenic or some kind of natural process that's altering the landscape, and you want to explore that. And often, problem solving in this kind of realm involves an iterative process, so some kind of system within which you can do rapid prototyping is ideal. Another unique kind of challenge is that you have collaboration across domains is often necessary in order to solve these kinds of problems. Like you'll have landscape architects that need to work with civil engineers, that need to work with land use planners in order to solve problems. And often these different groups have their own types of software systems that they're used to doing modeling in, and it's usually not the same one. So they don't sort of speak the same modeling language. So a tangible user interface that's got this affordance of you don't really have to learn how to use it is an ideal situation where you can have it on the tabletop and you can have all these people working together and exploring ideas together. So we drew our main inspiration from the MIT work, Illuminating Clay. And I'll go on and tell you about our system, but on the next slide I'll tell you what our main contribution was beyond these types of systems that were existing already. So previously the systems were sort of for hypothetical terrain data. You could model things, but now we can actually use terrain data that's collected to build our models, and we've done this by getting a GIS system involved. So we hooked up a GIS system, and this allows us to create the models based on real data. And then we have all of these powerful tools that GIS packs at our fingertips, so we can do analysis and compute a whole bunch of different parameters. So here's how the system, sort of the abstract design of the system works. We build a model, and this we'll go into detail on each of these steps in a moment. We build a model, and then the model is scanned with a laboratory 3D scanner. And from this we generate a raster digital elevation model. And then we can perform analyses on the DEM and project the results of the analysis back down onto the model. So you get this rapid feedback. Then, because our model is flexible, you can make modifications to the model and rescan the model. And then, you know, compute analysis on that and see the results. So it's a cyclical system. So first of all, a little more detail about the models. How do we build a model based on real terrain data? Well, you can use contours, and I'll show you how we do it by hand. Of course, you can do it with a 3D printer or other cutting devices, but by hand is appealing because it's pretty fast and easy, and most of all, it's really cheap. Okay, so what we do is we project the terrain contours of the area that we want to study onto a table, and then we can put down a piece of plain old styrofoam, trace the contours, cut them out, do this iteratively, and build up our model. Now we want to have a surface on top that's flexible, so we use plasticine clay and just roll it out and create a surface for the top and just wrap it around the styrofoam And there you have a surface that you can then play with, and it's malleable. You can also take, if you want to do modifications to the terrain, you can also take off pieces of styrofoam and things like that. Okay, so step two, scanning the model, and we'll link that with step five, projecting, because I want to show you what our prototypical system that we have in our lab. We've got the scanner and the projector sitting on a shelf above a table, about a meter above the table, and where we put our models. And then we can have the user bring their data on any portable device that they want to and just plug right into the system. And we're using the standard software from the scanner, and then we decided to use GraphGIS, but you could use any GIS system you wanted to. So generating the raster digital elevation model, basically that has three steps to it. If you want to combine your data with the scanned in data other data from that geographic area, you want to georeference your data. So you have this point cloud, you georeference it, and you import it to GIS, and then interpolate the resulting points, and that gives you a raster digital elevation model. Okay, so performing analysis. Well, we do this with our little black box, which we call GraphGIS software. One of the authors on this paper actually wrote the book, so that was an obvious choice for the GIS. But it's open source and free, so anybody could afford to build the system. And it's got lots and lots of functionality. I'll just show you a couple examples. Here's what we call a skyscraper in Raleigh, North Carolina. And this is the view shed that the GRASS system has computed for us. Here's another example, a speed map that's been converted to a time map. And then there was a cost surface run on it, so you could see the cost of getting to the scene of an accident from any point. OK, so now modifying the physical model. To show you this, we'll look at some examples that we've done in our lab. I'll show you three different applications. They're all in North Carolina. This one's near our campus. And we have one near the beach, or on the beach, rather, and one at a military training base, Fort Bragg. So this first application, there are issues when there's a heavy rainfall. One of the issues is there's a massive pooling next to one of the roads, which could lead to the road being breached. And that road is over there on that orthophoto. And the other thing is, so this runoff accumulates, and that is polluted, very polluted water, so that it's undesirable as well, contaminates the estuaries. So we built a 1 to 1200 scale model. And this is the model with the orthophoto projected onto the model. And now I'll be showing you a little demonstration of working with the system. In this demonstration, we attack what would happen if the road is breached. We take a piece of the road out. And then what if we try a simple, naive approach, put a dam in where the main flow is? Let's see if I can get over to that. So here we have the orthophoto projected onto the model. And now we're projecting a simulation of flow onto the model. So the model's been scanned, and then the simulation was run on the original model. And this is what happens with the original model. So now we stop it, we make a change to the model, and then we rescan it, and then we recompute the simulation. So you can see the water is now flowing through the breach in the road. And then we try our other idea, which is make a little dam out of clay and stick it in the main flow of the water. And then we can rescan the model and recompute the simulation. And we have the dam works well until there's a great deal of water, and then it flows over anyway. So this approach is not working out so well. But that's the kind of thing that you can see immediately when you play around with this system. Allows you to get that rapid feedback. Think about that one. Okay, so there are lots of different properties that you can project, that you can calculate with the GraphGIS and project onto the model. these, in this example, so this is the same model, and in the top it's the original with all these properties. In the bottom row, we actually had a landscape architect come in and play with this model. And he, of course, came up with a much more clever solution than building a little stupid check dam in the middle of the flow. And the, what he called these, he made these sort of curved structures all over the hill, and he called those swales. And you would, what you would do is you would look at the solar irradiation and see where the water flow is, and you would use that to decide where to put your plantings, things that the plants that like shady and plants that like to have their feet wet and that kind of thing. And that would be, you can see that that's doing already doing a much better job at controlling the flow problem, breaking it up. So this is our second study area that we have the Outer Banks in North Carolina. And this area has issues with flooding because it's got the ocean on one side and the Sound on the other. So it's not only sea water level rise because of climate change, but it's also storm surge. So whenever there's a big storm, you just get you get some really quick levels, water level rise. So, and a less obvious problem to me, what was surprising is that the dunes, though these dunes at this beach are very, very tall, and they migrate. So there were houses, in 2003, they decided to remove one of the dunes because it was impinging on a house. It was just, the sand was coming right up onto the deck, and they're moving along just because of the natural forces that are there. So what we did with our model was, well, we ran, there's no temple in the beach. That's just for reference. We built this 1 to 3,000 scale model. So you can see the dunes look very high. And what one thing that we do with our models is we usually do a 3xZ exaggeration, just so you can see what you're doing. And that goes into the calculations when we run the simulations. But they are very high, and so one of the things we did was, what if the dune hadn't been removed and was allowed to do its natural progression, which it would have taken over that house and crossed a road? So we put a piece of clay deck on the model and tested flooding with what if the dune were there. And another problem that you saw on the previous slide was this. So this house wasn't actually built in the ocean. It's what happens when the dunes are breached. So the water just sometimes cuts right through on the ocean side, and you get just crazy flooding. So we simulated breaching the dunes, and I'll show you a demo of that at the end. Our third application is a problem that the U.S. Army experiences in many places, because they do this training. This is actually a dirt airstrip. So you can imagine all the helicopters coming down, kicking up, it's sandy soil, it's kicking up all the soil, and then they have the heavy vehicles coming through, Humvees with those big treads. So it already has a terrible erosion problem, and then there's a big rain, and it comes in, it washes down, and it's created this gigantic ravine. You can see this tall man is standing in there, and it's taller than him. So there it is on the orthophoto of the area, and we've created another reference to how wide it's half as wide as the temple is tall. So again, we did the same kind of thing with this. We tried out various scenarios and looked at the soil loss results and saw the changes for that. So we filled in the ditch, we tried grading the airstrip, and building a little bit of dam. And you can see in the bottom right that there were patterns up in the top right, like these sort of diagonal patterns, and those had to do with where the vehicles were going, that have been broken up. And I'll just move on, but that's the kind of thing that you can do. So one of the things that we have a lot of fun with is we have people coming to the lab that want to see a demo. So what we do is we say, why don't you try it out? So they get in there and they try different scenarios. They can actually just use whatever they find in the lab and just start to play. So for example, in the top left, this architect decided, we were always in the habit of using these little square pieces of styrofoam to represent buildings. But in the top left, this architect put post-it notes to represent the buildings, and that's the kind of interesting result that he came up with. And then we have people like civil engineers who have a different kind of expertise, and they're sort of playing with different materials. That sort of bumpy bit in the middle of the stream is the non-skid carpet, stuff that you put under carpet. So if you put a permeable surface like that, it'll affect how the flow simulation goes, because at some point it'll slow down the water at least. So that represents what they call riprap, which is a bunch of stones that'll slow the water down. Anyway, and we also had groups of people coming in and working together. And they just come up with very interesting ideas. This lagoon was made from a CD, because this person knew a lot about lasers, and they said, well, this probably will give us an interesting result because it won't reflect the laser, and in fact, we got a null result right there, so we could then just set the level of the lagoon based on map algebra, whatever we wanted to. So we saw a lot of explorative interaction, which was pleasing. So there are certainly limitations to this project. We have, I showed you scale models that were relatively large scale, partly because if you want large cartographic scale, like 1 to 12,000, 1 to 3,000, versus 1 to 500,000, in which case you would then need to have changes that were much more significant than, so like taking the top of a mountain off, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to make a change as small as putting a dam in, because it would just be below what you could actually do in your physical resolution. And another thing that we're working on is, of course, we're actually doing running the simulations on the scanned results, right, from the model. So if you have water flow, you can imagine that it would be useful to also know what's going on outside in the surrounding area around your study region. So it's a little bit of a challenge to knit those together, but that'll be something we're working on. And then, of course, there's visualization. We've got a whole group of visualization people sitting here going, wow, color maps, right? So we're just using color maps because that's, you know, the initial thing, and also because people in those realms are used to seeing things in that way. Elevation is this color, you know. Flow are these colors and that kind of thing. So that's, I'm not sure how that's going to go with trying to introduce different visualization techniques. But of course, it would be interesting to see what happens when we try to use more sophisticated visualization techniques in this environment. Will all of the things that we know about perception that we've studied for using them on a monitor still apply on this sort of 3D model? Will the rules apply? And also, like, can we use the fact that we already have the topology there and just add other features on top? Or do we need to show the topology with our precious pixels? And there's changes in the hardware that's coming out that we'll be able to make the system even more portable. So in conclusion, we've created a tangible user interface that allows us to incorporate real terrain data, and then we can do all these different kinds of whatever the GrassGIS allows us to do. It's great for rapid prototyping. You try something, see how it works, try something else, and several people can come and work on it at the same time, and it's a language for different domain experts to work in. And it just, you know, obviously is allowing you to explore lots of terrain modifications. So with that, I will open the floor for questions.
Okay, if there are questions from the audience.
Thank you for this nice presentation.
Thank you.
This is a nice tool. I have a question. One maybe difficult part is that you have to build a physical model.
Yeah.
So for example, if you want to collaborate in the distance, it's kind of difficult to share. Did you look at using a stereoscopic projection through head-mounted display or this kind of device?
We haven't yet, but that would make sense.
Okay.
So, but how would that solve the problem of remote? Or that was a separate question.
No. I mean, I understand that the physical model works well
if
the two persons are on the same table, but if you have one person that is
in
one city and the
other in distance,
you cannot share the
physical model. As in any collaboration situation, it works better when you're together. How would that... I'm not sure if you're proposing the stereoscopic as an alternative, or...
No, I was just to know your opinion about using a stereoscopic display and see if there were some advantage, or if you experience... different behaviors or how the user could
I think
one
you're saying
that
use
the
a stereoscopic in the sense of having as an alternative to this kind of situation. Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess the big advantage of this is whatever your tactile senses bring to and allow you to do with a system that's creative. I think if you look at Ben Piper's dissertation, he talks a lot about the sort of implications of having a tangible user interface for this kind of system. I think it brings a lot of advantages. I mean, obviously, versus using a mouse or keyboard intuitively, it seems like you're going to be allowed to explore a lot more rapidly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for your nice presentation. It's very interesting. I've just one question concerning the precision. So if you're doing the model, is fingerprint, for example, modifying the model that large that it has an influence on the simulation, or do you have some blurring or filtering to... So your fingerprint, you leave a fingerprint in the plasticine.
For example. So are we picking up fingerprints? No, I don't think so.
No.
The reservation isn't that.
It's about the precision. Does a fingerprint has an impact on the simulation? For example, if you do the model with the plasticine and you're doing it with your fingers and you leave a fingerprint somewhere, in reality it would be a valley or about 1 meter, for example. Has this an impact on the simulation you're doing afterwards, after laser scanning this model?
If you press your finger onto the clay, you're making an impact. At that resolution, yeah.
So how precise is your...
We don't want people leaning on... Yeah.
And what is the resolution of your simulation or your scanning? Is it about 1 meter?
It's about one meter.
1 meter.
Yeah.
In cubic.
One cubic meter when it's georeferenced.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's about the same as the LiDAR data that we're using to start the model in the first place.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Aditi Majumdar from UCI.
Hi.
My question is mainly about the hardware. So are you using a scanner or you're using the projectors itself to do the getting the model?
So the question was what kind of scanner or?
Yeah, I mean, you are using a 3D scanner.
We picked the Vivid because basically this scanner, so scanners that are meant for laboratory are generally really close range, so you'd have to hold it right over the model, which we didn't want, or they're long range, like real sensing scanners. So the accuracy of the scanner and the object distance range was important.
So have you ever considered using the projector can itself be used to get the model, right?
The projector
can itself be used to get the model, to get the 3D depth and so on. So have you? Because if
just projecting the depth,
projecting
of
the
it.
Light, and then getting the.
Sure, I mean you could do that, but then how do you manipulate the model?
I mean, you can do it interactively. So my second question was, how interactive is this? Like when you change the model,
right?
How fast does it take to scan and then again reproject?
So you have to obviously remove your hands from it, and then we run the scan. And so it just takes seconds to run the scan. And then if you want to run simulations, however long the simulations take to run, and then you can project the results back down. So it's not scanning continuously.
But it is like in the seconds or minutes? That's what
the scanning only takes a few seconds.
And my second question was, have you faced the problem of like occlusion in the sense that when you are projecting?
Yeah, certainly if you lean over, you're leaning into the projector. So yeah, but I think it's sort of like you notice that it's happening, so you just sort of...
No, I'm not even talking about the occlusion by the person, but uh-huh. when one part of the scene, like for example, if you have a high mountain, and based on your projector position, you may find that other parts of the model are occluded by this mountain because the light is not reaching there. You have a single projector, right? You have one projector, right?
Yeah, I guess one of the limits, I mean, you could certainly add more projectors. Like it's not designed right now so that you could really do tunnels or anything like that. So yeah, that's a limitation.
Very nice work, though.
Thank you.
Two super quick questions for you.
Yes.
Very nice work. First, was the simulation something that's built into GRASS-GIS?
Yes, all the simulations that you saw are built into GRASS-GIS.
Okay, very cool. And second, you've mentioned some of the choices you made were because of cost and it was cheap to do. Say I wanted to create one of these from scratch and didn't have any of the components.
Your limiting thing is going to be the scanner.
Okay.
Scanners are expensive.
What would you estimate the total cost to be?
It depends on, well, there's newer technology that's coming out, but they're still not getting that much cheaper. I think the scanner cost, I don't want to say it wrong, I haven't actually bought it myself. I want to say that was like $30,000.
Okay, thank you.
So get a grant, buy it, and then you're done.
I'll catch the opportunity to ask one question as well. all right, we can take that offline. Okay, so we thank the speaker one more again. Thank you.